Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne. Thank you for joining us. On tonight's special edition of Haunted Nights Live, we're talking to two very exceptional authors who have penned one of the greatest, creepiest, most terrifying novels either of us have read in a long time. So we have two guests. First, Michael Scott is the New York Times bestselling author of more than 100 books for both adults and young adults. He has written both fiction and nonfiction, his fiction being primarily of the fantasy, science fiction, and folklore genres. His work has been published in 37 countries and translated into 20 languages. Melanie Ruth Rose has worked extensively in the entertainment industry throughout her career, completing numerous projects for the BBC, LWT, ITV, and appearing on the West End stage. Born and raised in England, Rose now lives in Los Angeles. Mirror Image is her first collaboration with Michael Scott. All right, that being said, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael Scott and Melanie Ruth Rose. Welcome to the show, you
good
guys.
Good evening, guys. How are you?
Yeah.
Good.
We're great. How about you?
We're great.
We're all fine.
Yep.
How are you guys?
Good,
it's
good.
So great.
Very well.
Thank you. We're so glad Michael's come all the way from Ireland just to talk to us.
Yep, yep.
I need a bit of sun, yep. Sunshine. I get tired of the rain coming in horizontal. I mean, it keeps the country very beautiful and very green, but sometimes you need a bit of sun.
Yep.
Get bloody hair, yes.
All right, so the first thing I want to say is your new novel, it's a collaborative novel called Mirror Image. This, we both received copies of it and are both currently reading it now, and we are both totally, thoroughly engrossed. This is, as I was saying a little bit before the show, this kind of has a really nice vintage horror feel to it, which is really great because this is like the stuff that I grew up on. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. And
Thank you.
Yes. I can't wait to finish it. But I guess what I'd like to know is, first off, how did you two meet, and how did it come to be that you wrote a book together?
Well, we met through our mutual manager, Michael. I was sort of like in awe of Michael because he's written so many books now. I had just finished writing a trilogy of erotica novels, and which is being currently shopped. And Michael had seen my work. And he also knows that I was an incredible lover of horror and gore, and I've been reading horror since I was a young girl. So we sort of like had a great understanding of horror when I first met him, and we just sparked off from there and thought it would be a good idea if we just collaborated together.
And, you
nice,
know, it's interesting
nice.
Because what I was looking for is, I mean, collaboration is such an interesting subject because writing is the loneliest job in the world.
Right.
And so it should be. But there are times when you do recognize that another voice, another creative input really will add an extra layer to your own work. And working on Image, which then became Mirror Image, I wanted someone who knew the classic horrors in the way that I knew the classic horrors and had grown up with the classic horror novels. And Melanie is English, and of course I would have grown up with that English sensibility. What we found, we had read some of the same horror novels, and we loved some of the same horror writers, and Melanie was a great friend, a great fan of my old friend James Herbert, who the wonderful, wonderful horror writer.
Oh.
And she has the worst taste in horror movies.
Thank you.
Even the movies I won't watch, she will watch. And the collaboration flowed fairly straightforwardly, and we didn't fight too much, or not that often, not regularly anyway.
Right.
And she generally won, so.
I think the only thing we're arguing and fighting about is a sequel, and that's about it. So
right,
it's very
right.
exciting.
Well, and I have to say, you know, as far as getting that you know, vintage, you know, horror feel that you were going for, you guys nailed it. This is awesome.
Yeah.
And I have to say, we Tamara and I collaborate also. We do, you know, collaborations, and we also even write together when we do our solo novels. And that is actually one of the questions a lot of people ask us is, you know, how bad do you fight? Do you fight at all? And apparently, you know, there are a lot of, you know, real horror stories within collaborations. And I think, you know, we all know that a lot of that's true. And, you know, but You guys, before the show, we were talking about it a little bit, and you guys don't fight. And I think that's great because we don't either. We truly don't. Sometimes I feel like we need to lie and say that we do, you know? Because people are
sexy. Yeah, spice it up.
It has to do, I think, with ego. I mean, we have all written writers who think that they are better than they are or are more senior or more superior or whatever. If you're collaborating, it has to be a 100% sharing, because you are exposing a huge chunk of yourself, and you need to be able to put that on the table and accept criticism and comment and a new mixture of ideas without feeling possessive. And I think a lot of younger writers, or sometimes a lot of insecure writers, are incredibly possessive of their own work. And, you know, Melanie and I are both very blessed in one way, because she, for example, is coming out of the theatre, which is the most collaborative of environments. And I've written before with collaborators, and you want to work with people whose work you respect. And that makes it so painless.
Yeah.
Right.
I think what it is also being able to define what is an argument and what is a helpful debate.
Right.
You know, I learned a lot of things when writing with Michael that, you know, I'm a sort of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants writer, whereas Michael is much more into plotting, you know, using an Excel spreadsheet and, you know, doing it that way, which was incredibly new to me, but it was the best way to do it.
It was
incredibly helpful. And, you know, of course, we were writing. I live in Los Angeles. Michael lives in Ireland, so there's an 8-hour time difference for a start. So he did introduce me to some sort of like programs that we would be able to use to sort of like help with that time difference. And so we could, you know, the collaboration could be much more smooth.
Right, right. Yeah. So this leads into your process, because what we do is we use the cloud. So we literally get on, what we do is we get on Skype. And we don't turn the cameras on. We just talk. And we write together.
Also character cute, yeah.
Yeah, and then once in a while we'll turn them on. But we communicate verbally, and then because we're in different states. We're not even in the same place.
Right.
And we communicate verbally, and then we write on the same page. So how do you guys do it?
Well, what would happen is I am, as Melanie mentioned, a plotter. I do plot everything. My last series, for example, the Nicholas Flamel series, was six books written over 6 years, which came out at about 650,000 words in total. All of the action in that series takes place in less than a week. So if I had just done that by seat of my... Well, I know, I would never do it again. It was so stupid. but it's like most writers. You come up with a great idea and then you instantly make it harder. So I like to plot, and with the Flamel series, I plotted it out in infinite detail. Similarly with this story, we plotted it out. I did a rough arc, and then Melanie and I actually worked on Skype and with FaceTime and WhatsApp, actually plotting it out chapter by chapter by chapter using a calendar month. In other words, what happens on Monday? What happens on Tuesday? What happens on Wednesday? Once we had that hammered out, once we had the overall plot hammered out, I wrote up a fairly rough 10 or 12 page draft, and then it was sent on to Melanie to add in her layer, and then she sent it back to me and I added in another layer. At the end of the day, we had a 40, maybe a 50 page series synopsis ready to go, and then we started writing. I would do a rough first draft, send it on to her, she would polish, send it back to me, and it went fairly seamlessly. Using a shared Dropbox folder, and we did look at Google. We did look at Google Docs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'd want someone watching me writing, so you can see the words magically appearing on screen. That's too weird.
Oh, that's what we do.
It's great because sometimes you're like sitting there and you're stuck, and all of a sudden the words just start going, and you're working.
Yeah.
And
the cursor moves.
I'm writing and I'm not touching the screen. Yeah,
I know, that's a bit weird. Also, the fact
that
so for him to watch me type would be terribly painful for him. I mean, I'm not a bad typist, but I'm a little bit slower than Michael, so he'd probably be pulling his hair out if he watched me type.
Hurry up! Hurry up! All All right.
But
then,
the other thing to do to keep our notes in sync was we used a shared OneNote file.
Oh, yeah.
And I really love OneNote. I've recently gone away from Evernote, which I used for a long time, and I'm really loving the OneNote. And one of the great things with OneNote is that we can both share the same notebook and update the notes in real time. So we're always working off the very latest data. Because as you know, as collaborators, one of the great problems is that one of you will change the hair color of a character and not tell the other.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and that either the hair color or the eye color, one of the other ones.
Yeah, we end up, what color is Belinda's eyes? Green?
Yeah.
Are you sure they're not blue? But we keep an edit, what are they called, a copy editor sheet of
all
that stuff, the cars and all that. And that helps, unless we forget to write something down.
Back to
the first book in the series. Yes, what color are her eyes? Maybe she has contact lenses and she changed them. We don't have to look if we do that.
Exactly. So you guys, so that's a little bit about your system. What is your schedule like? Do you guys get to, like, what are your writing schedules like? Do you do this all day, a few hours a day? Do you
end
focus
all night? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to say I actually write better in the evening. Just because I don't mind having the television on in the background, but with no sound. So I'll work in complete silence. I can't have a distraction, a verbal distraction, but I don't mind sort of like a visual distraction. That just makes me feel safe that there's something going on in the room. But other than that, it's just I'll write into the evenings, into the early hours of the mornings. And then some of the time during the day, if I'm out shopping or whatever I need to do, the book is constantly in my mind. Characters are constantly in my mind. And, if there are any problems or problems with plot, I tend to get away, go out. And then by the time I come back home, then, everything's nice and clean and sorted out. But, evening is best for me.
Right.
Whereas I would tend to work through the night, which goes back to my old... for many, many years, I worked as a bookseller, which is a great grounding for any writer because it gives you proper expectations. So I fell into the habit of working during the day and then writing at night. And it's still my best time. Unlike Melanie, I will write to music all the time, and I will often pick a piece of music to suit the scene that I'm writing. So I have a huge collection of soundtracks and ambient and New Age material. Very little with vocals because I don't want someone else's words in my ear.
Right.
Which is a bit disconcerting.
So we write
at night. And here's where the 8-hour time difference between Dublin and Los Angeles really works, because I can write a chapter, send it to Melanie, and by the time I get up 8 hours later, she will have polished her version and got it back to me. And that really does give the piece a certain energy, which I think if you're writing alone, sometimes it's missing.
Right.
I like having someone to answer to. We're both there. I'm not going to go fiddle around because I know Alistair expects things and vice versa. It's great to have a collaborator.
I think it's fun having a collaborator.
It is, and I love meeting people who are doing the same thing, especially people who are doing the same thing and get along. I think it's great.
Yes, it's so rare.
Because it's amazing. Because truly, it's amazing what you can come up with two heads like that. It's incredible.
It is amazing. As long as, as I think we touched earlier, as long as you keep the egos at bay. You can't collaborate and bring an ego with it, because it just doesn't work.
Right.
No, it really doesn't.
It doesn't.
Yeah, you get a collaborator who gets fond of a character that you want to cut and watch the sparks fly.
I've collaborated before, both with published and unpublished work, and a book which starts out with a good collaborator who suddenly decides they are an auteur rather than a writer is not a fantastic experience.
Yeah, that's kind of scary.
So I have one more question about your process, and then I want to talk about the book. Do you guys know where, like, can you go through, let's say, because I'm reading through Mirror Image, we're both reading it right now, and I don't see any place where I feel like, well, this is one author, and this is the other author.
Yeah.
Oh, and now we're back to the first author, which means it reads very seamlessly, which is really important
it
in collaborations.
Does.
I think a lot of times that's not the case, and you guys have totally got that down. So my question to you is, are you able among yourselves to read it and go, oh, this is me. Now this is where, you know, this is where, you know, Melanie picked up, and then, oh, this is where Michael took over. Or do you, are you able to even tell among yourselves?
I think you are able to tell. I mean, I can certainly read Mirror Image and go, oh, yes, I did. You know, that was certainly my contribution. And then I can read a part which was Michael's contribution. I think it's only because it's imprinted in your brain. Because
yeah.
you're writing it. But it's, you know, the idea about collaborating on a novel is for the reader not to even know that there are two voices. It has to be
right.
one seamless voice.
Exactly.
I right. will add that the really rude and violent and bloody bits are all Melanie's. So
I knew it.
That's how I know.
Yeah. Alistair will
the
write something and he will write something and say, I think I went over the top, and then I go back through it, and it ends up gorier. Isn't that
yeah.
always the way? Yeah. yeah.
You shouldn't. I mean, I think to take Melanie's point, if you can read a piece of work and say, oh, here is where author one stops and here is where author two begins, I think the authors
yeah.
have failed as collaborators. Similarly,
yeah.
yes.
I think if you can pick up a book and say, oh, this was written by a man or this was written by a woman, I think those authors have failed as well. I think
mm-hmm.
the story is the thing. It's just
right.
the story.
Yes.
What we
right.
did when we finished our back and forths, our many, many back and forths, is
yes.
I then took the manuscript and I did a final scrape and polish on it to give it a seamless
mm-hmm.
voice. And then once I was done, it went to Melanie to do her final pass. And then that was the final pass on the manuscript. But the great trick, I think, particularly with collaboration, is to read it aloud. If you can read it aloud and you're
yeah.
still reading it in your own voice, then you're absolutely golden. I think if you start reading it and you're stumbling or falling or it hasn't got its rhythm, which is you, the author's rhythm, then I think you know it's not working.
Right, right.
Yes.
I would agree.
Oh, that's so true. We read the previous day's work every morning. We have usually three projects going. So we read one, work on it. We read the second one, work on it, and so forth. And, yeah, that's the best way to edit. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. All right, so now I want to talk about this book. Okay, so I guess the first question would be, where did the idea come from? Well, actually, you know what? Before we do that,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Why don't you tell the listeners what Mirror Image is about?
Mirror Image is about a 7-foot-tall, 4-foot-wide, ancient piece of glass. And if you look into this glass, the glass is dirty and blurred. If you spill a little bit of blood on this glass, you will get to see what has been reflected in the glass throughout its history. And if you spill more blood on this glass, you will get to see the image, the beautiful woman who lives within. And if you feed her enough blood, she might just come out.
Nice.
Scary.
That was so
Very.
Good. I just have to say, that was so good when people ask me that. I'm like, well, it's kind of like
yeah.
this. That was amazing.
Yeah.
I think I have to promise you guys, once you've read Mirror Image, you'll never look at a mirror in the same way again.
I believe
it.
I'm not even done with it.
Yeah. No.
All right. Yeah, I'm not even done with it. It's very great. So okay, so now where did the idea come from?
Okay, this is a horrible question. You can ask writers 9 times out of 10, they will never
right.
know. This is one of the very, very, very few occasions when I can actually tell you where the original idea came from. I was having lunch in a restaurant in Dublin on the River Liffey, a rather grand restaurant, and as I was leaving, I passed on the wall a huge antique mirror. And I saw my own reflection, all broken and twisted and distorted in the glass. And I instantly stopped what I was doing, went back to the table, and this was in the days before I had my smartphone and all that good stuff, and on the napkin, an old-fashioned napkin, I wrote down the words, haunted mirror, And that's the genesis of the idea. And as we began to, as I began to work on it, and then subsequently Melanie began to work on it, you begin to realize that mirrors and reflections have really drifted in and out of world mythology. Every culture has a myth or a legend about a reflection or a mirror or a glass. But the deeper we dug into this, I'm principally an historian and a mythologist, I began to research the legend of Dr. John Dee. And Dr. John Dee was a real man. Dr. John Dee was Queen Elizabeth I's magician, mathematician, astronomer, astrologer, and spy. He was Queen Elizabeth I's spy. And when he would travel all across Europe pretending to speak none of the languages, but actually speaking most of them. And when he would send back his messages to the Queen, he would sign them in a certain way. And his signature were two long ovals that looked like O's, and a slash that looked like a 7, and he was the original 007. So when Ian Fleming came to give James Bond the call sign, that's where it comes from. And we actually have D's signature as 007. However, D also owned one of the original magic mirrors, his famous, what they call his shoe stone, S-H-E-W, his famous shoe stone, which has just been on display in London. And it is part of a series of occult and magical mirrors. So the mirror in the book, the mirror in Mirror Image, is actually based on a real mirror, which exists to this day, which is kept turned to the wall and its face perpetually covered by a black cloth.
Oh,
nice.
I love it.
Very fascinating.
You don't have to make this stuff up. Truth is always far stranger than fiction.
I know, right?
It is.
Seriously.
Wow. What were the properties of his mirror, the shoe stone there?
This is Dee's shoe stone. Dee claimed that when he spilled blood and other liquids on this piece of black, and it looks like, I have actually seen Dee's mirror, and it is a piece of black obsidian, probably Incan. And how a piece of, you know, this is when obviously the Spanish were just beginning to raid South America and Mexico, and a lot of artifacts from the New World were drifting home. So here we have Dee with an Aztec magical mirror. Dee talks about spilling blood and liquids on this glass and begin to see what he called the wonders of the age. He then began to believe that the angels were communicating with him. And out of this, he created a language called Enochian from the Book of Enoch. That's the genesis of Dee's mirror. And we have a wonderful story of Queen Elizabeth actually coming out to Mortlake, his house, to view this magical mirror, because Dee is the guy who chose the date for Queen Elizabeth's coronation. That's how important he is to her.
Wow.
So Elizabeth comes out to his house. She looks at the mirror. Whatever she saw in the mirror so frightened her that she would not actually go inside the house. And that's part of the historical record. That's part of Dee's shoe stone, Dee's mirror.
Interesting.
Wow.
And creepy. Very creepy.
And creepy. Yeah.
And creepy, yes.
Creepy.
Very creepy.
Very, yes.
Actually, before we go on, I'm gonna give you a moment to give us a little excerpt. But before that, while you're getting that ready, I'm going to take a moment to remind the listeners that this is Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne. You can learn more about what we do at our websites, which are alistaircross.com and tamarathorne.com. You can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com, or if you tweet, our handle is @thorncross. Be sure to visit us on Facebook on our Haunted Nights Live page. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. If you're listening online, please click the follow button. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. And before we get back to Michael Scott, Melanie, Ruth Rose, I just want to remind everybody that starting Monday, Tamara Thorne's novel Moonfall will be available for 99 cents in ebook at Amazon. So be sure and get, it's a Halloween story, so it's a great story. It's the first Tamara Thorne novel that I read many moons ago, and I highly recommend it. Get it for 99 cents. All right, so I would love to hear an excerpt from Mirror Image.
So we tossed a coin, and I lost. So Paul won. So I'm going to read you a tiny, tiny short piece. As we go through the novel, we do get glimpses into the mirror, or we get the mirror's POV. And these are quite short chapters, so I've picked a really short one to read to you. And here we have the mirror slowly becoming awake. A little bit of blood has been spilled on the mirror by this stage, and it's beginning to awaken. Power, raw, coursing strength, confusion, pain, anguish. It had felt these before, but these sensations were stronger, much stronger now. This was no animal. This was a human soul in mortal agony. The colours in the other world now were bright, sharp, clear, clean colours slicing through the greyness. The quickening was upon it. The past was returning. Memories of promises made, oaths sworn, oaths broken. Forever and ever. This was a petty life, a female life, not a virgin, but responsive. It savoured the life, a foretaste of the feast to come. Blood dripping. The tang of it in the dust of the other world. Colour. And with the colour came life and memories, sensations and emotions, and the blood was the life.
Nice. Very nice.
And a silence fell upon the room.
Sorry.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, when we have
is that
a
it?
What you're trying to read, we try to be very polite, just in case.
Yeah, you never know. We don't have any visual cues, so
yeah, so
you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. But no.
I should have queued you up and said I'm going to read you chapter 12. You know.
Oh, yeah.
I know, right? So
it's really wonderful.
It is. It's wonderfully worded, and we'll get into that later. I guess you know right now what I'd like to know is what can you tell us about Jonathan Fraser? He's a really I like this character. I really do.
Yeah,
let's talk about him, how you developed him, where he came from, anything you want to tell us about him.
Well, Jonathan Fraser, very sort of like an ordinary gentleman, as it were. He's an interior designer. He's furniture. He has a store in Beverly Hills, which is, you know, by appointment only. Nice guy. He's got a wife, Celia, and a daughter, Manny. He's a workaholic. And we see that he went back to London to bid on an antique mirror. It's coming up to the holidays. He was there. He wanted to get stock for his showroom because he's got high-end clients who would love to come in and purchase gifts for their other halves or their own friends and so forth. And so he purchases a mirror at an incredibly cheap price. So it's really the story about Jonathan and his love of his work, his store, and his discord with his wife, Celia, but his love for his daughter, Manny. And as we move forward in Mirror Image, we see how he has been sort of transfixed and transformed by the mirror. The mirror is giving him energies. The mirror is feeding off of his energies, and then he begins feeding off of the mirror's energies and begins to let the mirror seduce him.
Nice.
The other thing
nice.
To add about Fraser is it's always interesting to take an ordinary character, a character grounded in the real world, and then shift them ever so slightly, which is what happens to him. I spent many years working as an antiques book dealer, and I bought and sold antique and rare books. So I'm familiar with the guys who would have bought at auctions, and many of them are obsessed. I mean, this is what they do, and this is what Fraser does, and he's based on, you know, an amalgam of several antiques buyers that I know, and Melanie, who had a career as an interior designer in Hollywood, you know, knows this world extremely well. And when she talks about it, I mean, she mentioned this to me at one stage, that there are shops in Beverly Hills which are by appointment only, which is just so bizarre to me, that you cannot just wander by and wander in. You have to have an appointment to go visit these shops.
Right. It is. It's fascinating. It's a whole different world, actually.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, this is a question for both of you. Let's go with Melanie first. What are you most proud of about this book?
What am I most proud of?
Yeah, is there a, I don't know, whether it's a scene it could be, or the response you're getting, or just what makes you most proud
actually,
about
it? Actually, you know what, I think it has to be, apart from, you know, having a book published, which is always a great honor, I think it's also how it's been received.
Right.
I love the fact that I've looked at several reviews and who've actually said, oh my gosh, it actually exists. John Dean. I think that's quite a thrill. I love the fact that people that find it intriguing, love the way it's been written, and that's a thrill for me. There isn't one part of the book that I'm really proud of. It's the whole book and the reviews, the great reviews it's received thus far.
Right, right. What about you, Michael?
I have a slightly different attitude, and I keep telling Melanie, don't read the reviews because you're going to come up against a horrible one in a minute. And personally, I love a really bad review because it tells you so much about the reviewer rather than about the book. But to take Melanie's point, people are the response to this has been really interesting. This was written as an homage to the old-fashioned horror that we all grew up with, which here is an ordinary man in an extraordinary situation which gets out of control. This isn't happening in his mind. This is not a psychological horror. This is a straightforward, old-fashioned, ultimately a creature feature. That's what it is. And I think people like yourselves who have read it and who know the genre have really responded in such a positive way. And that's been great fun because you know yourselves. You can spend a year working on a book, and whether it's individually or whether it's collectively, you really have no idea whether it's any good or not. You have to be confident in your work, but you just don't know, you know,
until it goes
out into the real world. And then the second half of the process, because writing is only half the process, the reader actually completes that process. So it's when it goes out into the world and you guys read it, that validates the work. Because a book is only dead words on a page. It's the reader who brings them alive.
Right. That's a really good point. And I do like what you said though about the reviews, because we both don't read reviews. If we get really good ones, you know, there are people around us who say, "Oh, you got this great review," blah blah blah. But I don't. Yeah, we just don't. It's hard because if you get, I don't know, the good reviews kind of make you, you know, feel good. The bad reviews make you feel bad, but I don't know how much it really changes the way you're doing things.
Well, it's important to be. It's important to be true to yourself.
I think you have to take reviews as it's one person's opinion. Not everybody is going to have the same opinion, because if we did, we'd all be really boring as human beings. I don't. You know, I love the good reviews. I love the mediocre reviews, and I love the bad reviews because they make me giggle. And I'm like, go read it again. But it doesn't bother me. I just take it for what it is. I think I'm just proud that we've got a book out there. It's Mirror Image by Michael Scott and Melanie Ruth Rose. And, you know, it's out there.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And it's great. We both highly recommend it.
Yes.
I want you just to keep saying that. By the way, I'm going to put it on the cover of the paperback, you know.
Yeah.
You know, what you want, it's always, and I've been writing for a very, very, very long time. And as time goes by, you realize that, A, you're writing for yourself. And I'm sure you guys are exactly the same. You write the books you want to read. Because that's what we do.
Exactly.
We're, you know, someone else isn't telling the story. Well, you know what? I'm going to tell it myself. That's why we, as writers, write. If you guys won the state lottery in the morning and you had your $500 million, would you stop writing? No, because it's what you do.
Right.
And it is wonderful when you do push the book out there and you do get people like yourselves who know the genre and have grown up in the genre and who are saying, actually, I rather like this. You know, it works. It makes all of the past year or 18 months really worthwhile.
Right.
It does.
Right. Totally. But yeah, and that's a good question because it's true. I mean, if we won the lottery, I know we'd still be doing what we do every day because it's just, you love it. It's
You just have better computers.
Yeah. Actually, I'd probably just buy a tea percolator that could make me tea all the time. That's the only thing I'd require.
But she is pretty.
Now, this is, you mentioned that, Michael, you mentioned that you've been writing for a long time, and that is no lie. You are the author of over 100 books, is that correct?
106 or 107, something like that.
Yeah. I think it's 108.
Wow. Oh, okay, I keep forgetting one, yeah.
Wow.
So,
that's not that unusual. I mean, I don't think it's that unusual.
No.
I started writing, I published my first book in 1982, and I was working as a bookseller, which is a great job, as I said, for any author. If you work in a bookstore or in a library, you can stand in the middle of that room and look around you, and you will recognize maybe 10 authors. You know, you're going to recognize the big authors and the best-selling authors, but who writes the rest of the books? And it became clear to me as a very young bookseller that people were doing this, and they were doing it day after day and week after week and book after book. And that's how I began to write. I wrote for myself, and I wrote many books. And I was a long time into my career before I had any real success. And it really is, you just have to ignore all those people who tell you you won't do it, you can't do it, you shouldn't do it, and you press on. Because ultimately, writing you're doing for yourself.
Right.
First and foremost.
And you've hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Very late. I mean, I'd been writing, I mean, I think the Flamel books, I had written something like 100 books before that actually happened. And for some reason, the Flamel series, for reasons best known to itself, just took off. And suddenly, it was in 25 languages, and suddenly it was in 35 countries. And it has been a phenomenon. It really has been a phenomenon. But, you know, to people who are starting on their writing careers, it took me nearly 30 years to do that.
Right. Yeah, it's a tough business. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, Melanie, is this? I'm not sure if this is your. Pardon me. You said you wrote some erotica and stuff like that, and this is your first. This is your first novel with Michael.
Yeah.
But
this is my first collaboration with Michael. I have been writing for quite a few years. I have written a trilogy of erotica novels. Book one, which is with my New York agent at the moment, I've been blessed because it's already been optioned for a TV series.
Wonderful.
Which is quite amazing, and I'm very proud of that. So it's being considered at a couple of publishing houses at the moment, and then I will just carry on writing. And Michael and I have plans to do a sequel to Mirror Image, which we're working on at the moment as well. But this is my first collaboration, yes.
Nice.
You were on the stage in the West End, right?
Goodness, yes, at the tender age of 13. I was in the original cast of the musical Annie.
Wow.
Where I played the part of Tessie. So that was my first job.
So you've
horrified
been
my mother, of course.
But you've been in the, you know, entertainment industry, you know, for, you know, your whole life.
Your whole life.
Like. And
almost 15, 20 years I was in the entertainment industry. Yes, just working either, if not in the West End, on musicals such as Annie, Get Your Gun, 42nd Street, Dame of the Sea.
Wow.
I've seen all of those. Yeah.
Oh, yes. 42nd Street was the longest. I was there for about 3 years. And then, between that, I also did an awful lot of television for LWT, BBC, and ITV as well. So entertainment has featured the majority of my life. And then when I came over to Los Angeles, I still kept that creative field. And then started my own interior design company.
Wow.
Now, I have to ask, because I'm a native of Los Angeles as well.
Fabulous.
How do you feel? Yeah, I'm not too far away from you. What did you think of, what was the culture shock like leaving Britain, you know, London, for L.A.?
It was quite a culture shock for me. I think the funniest thing was, you probably don't think about this, was the language barrier. There were certain words that are quite different over here than they are in England. And I remember many moons ago, I was in a wonderful creative art store, and I said to my former mother-in-law at the time, I just said, oh, I need to get some pencils and some rubbers. Where do they keep the rubbers here? And she looked at me and she went, oh. I went, what? She went, rubbers? They call them erasers. And I was like, oh my God. I said, well, what the hell's a rubber then? She went, condom. And I was just beside myself.
Oh.
So.
Fanny is my favorite.
Yeah, Fanny.
Catch on to Fanny means something a lot different. Oh, it's
I know,
the other
actually,
side of what we think it is.
Oh,
yes,
I
and
see.
The funny thing is, I was when I was in England, I had an American come up to me, and I was wearing what we call a bum bag, and this is way many moons ago, and she came up to me and she said, "Love your fanny pack." And I went, you can't say fanny pack, because fanny means something completely different in England.
Well, as George Bernard Shaw said, it's two nations separated by a common language.
Right, yes. Right.
Oh, I love the differences.
That's awesome.
So there were a few cultural shocks along the way, but you know what? I love the weather, so I'm not complaining.
Even now with the drought.
Yeah,
it's so hot. Yeah.
So now, okay, so for the listeners, I just want to remind the listeners that the book is called Mirror Image. The authors are Michael Scott and Melanie Ruth Rose, and this is, well, you know what? Right here on the cover, I think that Brian Lumley sums it up probably better than I possibly could, which is horror the way it should be written. I agree. This is good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're reading it. We're loving it, and I would. One thing that I would really like to know, you guys have mentioned more than once that you are working on a sequel to this. Where are you at in that? Like, is it close? I mean, it's a process, I know, but are you already getting
it? How long
do
we have to wait?
Yeah. Right.
I'd like to think not too long. however, the bare bones and the structure is there. So we're off into our layers and things like that at this moment in time. So we're currently back and forthing with chapters. And then I'm hoping we should be finished in the next couple of months.
Nice.
Once you come to the end of the book, you will see there is a very logical next step. And that's the logical next step we want to explore. The big fight now is what do we call it? You know, what do we call the sequel?
Right. That's always
the
it.
The
fight
is usually the last thing.
You know, a lot of times it is, and that actually brings me to an interesting question. It's a topic that's actually really interesting because everybody feels kind of differently about it. How do you guys go about coming up with titles or even names of your characters? Or, you know, this is, for some reason, I don't know how you guys feel, but for us, this is like, one of the most important things. If a character doesn't have the right name, it's just not right. Do you know?
Yeah.
So how do you guys go about that? How do you guys go about that?
Well, it really depends on the work. Nothing irritates me more or will bounce me out of a story is if I'm reading a novel and the character has a name which is either inappropriate or would not have been in common usage. I was reading a Western very recently by a well-known Western writer, and he used a very modern name, which is Courtney. Now, Courtney, for a female character, great name, but it was not a name that would have been used in the Old West. And it just bounced me out of the story a wee bit.
Yeah.
When we're starting, I mean, Jonathan Fraser, what we wanted was a strong character name. It had to be a slightly guttural sound, so Jonathan is a good name. Fraser is sort of respectable, but it's a middle-class name. It tells you all you need to know about him and his character. Certain characters, like some of the lesser characters in the story, didn't actually have names, and I would often write them as A and B until we sort of settled into them, until those characters had revealed themselves. Because there isn't a strong historical layer running through this, and we do go back and tell the D story. You know, people like John D, and Edward Talbot and Edward Kelly, they were real people. So they are real names, and we had that to fall back on.
Yeah.
But I think you're perfectly right. I mean, names are, you know, a name will make or break a story. I've actually had to change a young adult novel I was writing recently because another author had used the same name I was going to use.
Yeah.
And you know what that's like.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I also, I don't know if you guys do this, but I always like to have an image of that person and have that name match, you know, match that image. So I have them clearly in my mind.
Right.
And so they do become a real person to me.
Right. One thing I'm interested in, this kind of goes back to the dynamics of your working relationship. I can listen to you guys and I can hear that there's like no competition between you, which I think is fantastic. And I think that's the key to a successful, partnership. However, one thing that I think is really interesting is you said that Michael is apparently a very thorough plotter. Melanie, you're more of a fly by the seat of your pants. So now Tamara and I are both kind of like, we kind of fly by the seat of our pants. So I think, Is there any conflict there? Like was there ever a time, Michael, where it seemed like Melanie was going out in left field, or was there ever a time, Melanie, where it seemed like you wanted to go beyond the plotting?
To be honest with you, no. I'm not going to argue or second guess an author who's published 108 books. I'm in awe.
Right.
I've got a lot of writing to do to catch up with that. So, no, I'm going to listen to him. I think you can, I'm certainly not going to criticize. Listen to him, take on board. Because if it's going to help me in my, you know, with my writing, of course I'll use it that way.
Well, let me just add a piece to that. For example, when I'm plotting, the novel opens in London, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it opens with Jonathan Fraser buying the antique mirror at a London auction house. That's all my note said. Jonathan Fraser buys antique mirror in London auction house. So, Melanie Rose gets on a plane, flies to London, spends a week, unnecessarily, by the way, but hey, trolling around London, visiting all the places she used to love and live in, but doing her research. And out of that, she wrote her chapter. And I think probably I changed two words. So within the framework, there has to be flexibility. You have to allow the collaborative process to flow back and forth. She's the one who chose Lotts Road, which is the big auction house area of London. Similarly, you know, there's a throwaway chapter where we talk about Fraser's antique shop in Beverly Hills. Again, you know, because Melanie knows Beverly Hills extremely well, because that's where she shops, of course.
would like to shop.
That's where she would like to shop, by appointment.
Yeah.
You know, so my note was, the police officers visit Fraser's shop in Beverly Hills. That scene was, again, you know, designed and written by Miss Rose because, you know, and the notes are not set in stone. The notes are really to make sure, as authors, you're on the same page, but you can be on different sides of the same page. And as long as the finale works, as long as you know where you're going, because that's the hard part, you know, within that framework, you have a lot of flexibility and movement.
Yes, and I also just wanted to add is that, yes, I did travel to Lotts Road. I did travel back to London. It's extremely expensive, I might add now. So I was glad to get back to Los Angeles. But also it added a layer of authenticity to the story. If I can see it, if I know it, if I've been there, I can, you know, I've got the smells, then that's even better for me to produce the writing for Michael. Same with, you know, Jonathan Fraser's home in the Hollywood Hills and his store in Beverly Hills. I went to places where I felt comfortable. This is where this character would have his store. This is where Jonathan and Celia and Manny would live. So it added that, as I said, a layer of authenticity when we were writing the novel as well.
And the other piece I'll jump in and add is that readers are smart, and the readers are a lot smarter than you. And if you make a mistake, they will take great joy in telling you. Usually instantly.
Yes, they do.
But also, yes. if you make a mistake, you do break that bond with the reader. It will bounce them out of the story. And mm-hmm. you've got to be fair to your reader at all times. So I don't think you can wing it. I had someone very recently, a young author, brilliant young author, tell me that she did all her research on Google Earth. Which I said, well, that's fine, but how do you know what it feels like and smell like and looks like and the light? What is the light like? What are the people like? You cannot get you. You know, writing is the greatest mm-hmm. excuse in the world to travel. That's what it is. Yeah.
Writing is
travel.
Yeah.
Well, and you can, and it's amazing. You don't even realize how important it is until you sit down to write something, even if you've been there. For example, not too long ago, I've been to bars before. I've been to a bar.
No.
But it's been a few years, and when I sit down to write a scene like that, I find myself at a loss. And you can go look on YouTube, I guess, but instead you just go and you can get all the sounds, you can get all the smells, you can get the feeling, the vibration of the place. And even if you've already been there before, you kind of have to commit it to yourself in a different way to translate it on the page. So I'm all for that. I think that you kind of have to do those mm-hmm. things. I don't think
write
it's
what
a,
you know.
A waste. Yeah, exactly. And if you don't know it, learn it.
Yeah, and taking a lot of photographs. I've always found that taking images of specific areas, you know, I travel with luck enough these days, I think, with iPhones and cameras, that if I see an extraordinary person or I find somebody that, like, you know, a coffee shop or something like that, there's something that's really interesting and perhaps they're closed in a very unusual way, I'll put up my camera and take a photograph and then just put it away and file it, because I may use that character later on down the line in another book. Or
exactly.
I'll show it to Michael and say, hey, look at this. This is Peter. You know, he's perfect, or she's perfect.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We do that.
Tamara texted me once, and she's like, get on Netflix and look up, you know, this show, and that's our character right there, and it's true. It was great.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm curious about, as I've said, this mirror image it's got this really kind of authentic vintage horror vibe that I really, really like. So for each of you, and I'll go with you first, Michael, who influenced you, the writers?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm in an unusual position because about 50% of my work is for young adults and the other 50% is for adults. So, and it's always easier for me to answer the young adult question first. And in fact, I'm going to throw this question back at you because it's a really interesting experiment. So for both of you, name me a single book from your childhood. Single book.
The Ghost That Goofed.
Okay.
Dandelion Wine. Dandelion Wine, Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, by Ray Bradbury. You, I'm going to suggest, are referencing books that you read 20 years ago, 30 years ago, more maybe?
Mm-hmm. The one that I mentioned I read probably, let's see, I'm 30 years ago.
Yeah.
This is like a little kid book.
Yeah.
This is like, she said Dandelion Wine, and now I'm like, oh, geez, mine was like practically a coloring book, but
I
loved it.
Yeah. I mean,
in second grade, yeah.
I can talk about The Borrowers, written by Mary Norton, about the tiny wee people who live under your floorboards and steal your stuff. Again, we're talking about a book I read 40 years ago, maybe more. That's the power of young adult writing. Now, here's the next question.
Yes.
Name me a horror book, not any other genre, but name me a horror book that made such an impact on you.
Gerald's Game by Stephen King.
The Haunting of Hill House, sixth grade.
Oh, it's such a
my life.
Wonderful book. Now, that's the power of horror. And if you say to me, name me a horror book, I'm going to reference something like maybe James Herbert's The Rats, which is an incredibly visceral horror novel, which I read when I was far too young to read it. Horror leaves an impact in the way that other genres don't.
I agree.
And look, I read a lot of science fiction, a lot of fantasy, a lot of horror, but horror is the one that leaves the impact. I remember reading Ray Garton's Live Girls when I was maybe 15.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again,
yeah.
shouldn't have been reading it. But, you know, they are the books that stick with you. There's an English writer called Guy Smith,
oh,
who
yeah.
who has half a dozen really good books and then a lot of other books. He did a book called The Sucking Pit, about a piece of marshy land that you throw various bodies into, and one day the marshy land throws them back up again. I was maybe 12 when I read that, and it had such an impact on me. That's the power of horror writing.
Yeah.
And a lot of our great classic literature is horror. Frankenstein is horror. Dracula is horror. I would argue that Alice in Wonderland is also horror.
Yeah,
oh,
I
yeah.
can see that. Seriously, well, even the Grimm's fairy tales, they're pretty horrific if you read the
Grimm's fairy tales, Struwwelpeter, Dorian Gray. All of these, the books that we remember, have elements of horror because horror speaks to us in a very interesting and primeval way.
That's
the Hound of the Baskerville.
Yeah, I'm going to remember that. That's good stuff. All right, Melanie, your turn. Who influenced, what writers influenced you?
Okay, so when I was very young, I picked up a book at the airport, and it was The Rats, James Herbert, and I took it on holiday with me. My mother at the time thought it was by a book about an English vet called James Herriot. So she'd completely got the authors muddled. One was about a nice, you know, comfy village-type vet, and the other one was about rats by James Herbert. So she wasn't too happy when she found that out. It was James Herbert, Stephen King, Edward Lee, like Michael Ray Garton, and Jack Ketchum.
Nice.
Yeah, see, Melanie likes the much darker stuff than I do, you know?
Yes.
The really dark stuff.
Yeah.
I can't get enough of it. One book goes down, another, that's it. I'm reading them all.
Yeah, we had just recently, I think in June, we had Ray Garton
on.
Yeah, he's
fabulous,
great. Yeah, we've had some, he's been great. He was great, yeah. We got to get him back. But anyway,
so young.
I love all of that gore. I love all of that. But then I think it's probably because I'm a very curious mind.
Right.
When we first came on, you mentioned, or Michael mentioned, that Melanie, you watch much darker movies, much gorier movies than Michael does. What movies do you both like? Start with Melanie.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Horror movies? Gosh, off the top of my head, you've caught me there.
What did you watch recently? Ouija board or something?
Oh, yes, I'll watch the Ouija board, I'll watch The Conjuring, I'll watch all of those.
Nice.
I don't think there's anything that has really... A Poltergeist, when it first came out, I loved all of that. There was nothing that's ever scared me. There is one book by Jack Ketchum that really did give me the heebie-jeebies, but it was based on a true story. And that one I had to think, oh my goodness, that's the first time in years. Which sort of gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Was it the girl next door?
Sorry.
Was it the girl next door?
Oh, the girl next door, yes.
Is that the one? Yeah, because that scared the hell out of me too. That and The Stranger Beside Me by Anne Rule, because it's about Ted Bundy. And I'm with you. It's the real life stuff that scares the hell out of me. Totally scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, and being as curious as I am. Of course, when I read the back, and I was like, oh, my gosh, I had to go and research the original story.
Yes.
Which made it even more terrifying.
We're getting motioned that we have to leave. It's counting down.
Oh.
I didn't know that was going to happen. So very quickly, the book is called Mirror Image by Michael Scott and Melanie Ruth Rose. And very quickly, can you tell us where readers can find out more about you guys?
I have a website, MelanieRuthRose.com.
All right. And you, Michael?
You'll find me. I'm DylanScott.com. And I'm all over the web, and so is Melanie.
Yes, I'm on Facebook and on Twitter. So I'm Pinterest.
And Pinterest. All right. We are going to look you guys up, and we will send you requests. And we're out of time very abruptly, but we're out of time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much for being
on.
Thank you. The book is Mirror Image. It's fantastic. If you love horror, you're going to love it. Until next week, we wish you all haunted nights.
And sweet screams.
Thank you for listening. And thank you, Michael and Melanie, for being on. We appreciate it, and we will be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night, guys.
Thank you. Thanks.
Good night.